First case in our calendar, 09305, Christine Banford versus Aldrich Chemical Company. Mr. Foose.
Good morning. My name is Marty Foose, and I'm representing the appellant, Aldrich Chemical Company. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and Mr. Gordon Ankeny will be handling the rebuttal. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The trial court exercised its discretion properly in every way. The Court of Appeals overstepped its bounds. It should not have overturned these jury verdicts. To demonstrate how the Court of Appeals overstepped its bounds, I'll begin with the second issue. This is the one dealing with the evidentiary questions. These are entitled to abuse of discretion. These relate to town hall meetings that occurred well after the conclusion of the explosion and the evacuation in this case, and the past history at the Isotech plant. The trial court issued its ruling, which is found on appendix page 190, and it held that these matters were not relevant, and whatever relevance they may have was substantially outweighed by the unfair prejudice. That unfair prejudice involved confusion of the issues and misleading the jury. Essentially, the jury could easily be confused to award damages for punitive reasons rather than compensatory reasons. The Court of Appeals ignored this ruling and instead headed out in its own direction. It did so ignoring that abuse of discretion is there because the trial court knows the facts better. And what the Court of Appeals ruled on appendix page 47 was that this evidence, quote, might have been of some relevance in explaining the issue of the alleged damages for the continuing nuisance. Might have been some relevance is speculation, and speculation should never be sufficient to overturn on an abuse of discretion standard. And the continuing nuisance is confusing because it was never argued at the trial court. There was no evidence presented. That argument was never raised with the Court of Appeals. And even here in this court, a discussion of continuing nuisance and its elements, such as the existence of fresh violations, has not been briefed. So this is the Court of Appeals heading out on its own. The Court of Appeals also overstepped its bounds on the first issue on appeal. And turning to that issue, this is the one in which the Court of Appeals ruled that it was improper to require proof of physical discomfort as part of the instructions in a nuisance case. This is brand new. For the first time in Ohio history, the Court of Appeals allowed recovery for damages in a nuisance case for something other than physical discomfort. The appellees argue that Aldrich already admitted away the physical discomfort requirement because physical discomfort is part of whether or not a nuisance exists, but it should not be part of the damages determination. That's what they're alleging. Just setting aside the logical inconsistency of this argument, it also contradicts the case law because the trial court was following Bullock. Bullock is cited in our brief, our reply brief on page 5. It's a 2001 case, so it's very recent, and it's good law. What makes Bullock so important is that it's a damages-only case. The issue as to whether a nuisance existed had already been determined and was not a subject of that decision.
Mr. Foose, with respect to the admission that was made in this case, because there's some discrepancy or some conflict in what exactly was admitted. The company specifically admitted breach of duty. Is that correct?
Yes. If you think of every tort in its most basic form consisting of existence of a legal duty, breach of that duty, causation, and damage, what was admitted was existence of a legal duty and breach of that duty. But the tort had not yet been proven completely because there was still causation and damage to be proven.
So when the phase was before the court with respect to each individual and the reaction to the explosion, Was the issue also to be determined that causation on each case was to be determined in that phase as well?
In phase two, causation on an individualized basis as well as damage was to be determined, yes.
All right.
And the Bullitt case is such a case. It's the same situation as ours, meaning it was a determination of damages. And in that case, it applied the Antonex standard and said, for damages, quote, the factual question is whether there is an appreciable, substantial, tangible injury resulting in actual material and physical discomfort. Bullock is not the only damages case that we cited. We also cited the Schoenberger case and the Widmer case, all found in our reply on page 5. This standard is not optional. The words were chosen for a reason. And if you look at the standard, it repeats itself to make the point. Substantial, tangible, material, and physical.
Counsel, you keep emphasizing physical. Mm-hmm. Are we to understand that your view of this is someone who just has a very strong emotional reaction to an event like this would not be compensable?
Not as part of nuisance. Nuisance would be for those physical discomforts, but we already have something in Ohio law for emotional discomforts, and that's the infliction of emotional distress standard found in the Paw decision. There's no reason to change Ohio law. We already have standards. So in that situation, if someone were to have very strong emotional reaction, they could easily plead and prove the Paw standard.
Okay.
What are physical discomforts? Physical discomforts are those that affect sight or our senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell. And again, the Schoenberger and the Widmer cases explain that this is the proper understanding for a physical discomfort. It doesn't have to be, I mean, this standard was created not to allow these types of claims where there isn't a necessary a physically trespassing situation or a physical injury. It was to allow things like in the Miller versus Horn case, a pet kennel and cemetery that made a lot of noise and extreme odors, or bright lights in the Tullis case. Requiring proof of physical discomfort fits with the rest of Ohio law.
Has the Ohio Supreme Court ever spoken on this subject? You cite Chamberlain. That's from the 9th Appellate District, is it not?
I believe so.
Has this court ever articulated it in any cases?
This court has said in many cases they don't necessarily go through the full litany of the Antonet case, but they do speak in terms of substantial and material discomforts.
So what you want us to do is
clarify the law.
Reiterate that or adopt the standard that was promulgated in Antonick in this case? Is that what you're asking us to do here?
Basically, to clarify that the law in Antonick and its progeny is good law.
Is it necessary for us to separate nuisance from emotional damage? I mean, obviously, when there's an explosion and your house begins to shake, people could be concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have a fear. And your view is it may be compensable under one theory of recovery, but not under nuisance.
I think that's the cleanest solution here because it fits with Ohio law as it already exists. There could be a situation where you would import the severe and debilitating standard from PAW to include with nuisance, but I think that gets confusing and it starts to change what Ohio law is.
So you suggested that the trial court got it right. So what you're asking us to do is simply overrule the Court of Appeals and reinstate the verdict of the trial court.
That's exactly right.
Counsel, we have liberal pleadings designed to, at the end of a trial, you can even move to amend the pleadings to conform to what the evidence demonstrated here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the choice of words and distinguishing the differences in the choice of words and the charge to the jury, the one that the judge chose versus the one the Court of Appeals is suggesting would be appropriate. It's a pretty fine line, it would seem. I'm having some difficulty exactly knowing where that line ought to be. I mean, here's an occurrence. Probably most of the stress was caused from the local officials' decisions to move everybody out of their homes, which then says to people something serious and very bad must have happened. People react differently to those kinds of things. You know, the guy at Mount St. Helens stayed in his house as the top of the mountain's blowing off. Didn't work out so well for him, but other people, you know, you can understand some people may never want to live in their home again just off of something like this.
I think for those individuals that have facts that could arguably get close to proving the severe and debilitating standard, that they could proceed then to a jury with their infliction of emotional distress claims. For these first plaintiffs that were tried in April of 2007, and for the appellee in particular, her claims and her facts, as it turned out, were not anywhere close. And so the court had granted summary judgment on that. And that's one reason why he instructed the jury that they would not be awarding damages for the emotional. I see that my time is up.
Counsel, I wanted to ask you a question so I understand what your argument is. Let's say somebody's house rattled and shook, and they were startled by it, and it caused them temporary fright. Your argument is that is not annoyance and inconvenience and should be disregarded in terms of awarding compensation?
Certainly they could explain to the jury the shaking of the house. And certainly that effect could be made known to the jury, and certainly they would probably be able to get in all their reactions to it, to just explain what it was that they did and how loud the noise was and how much of an impact that meant on them. So I think all of that could come in, and that could be compensable
as
physical discomforts.
That would be inclusive, but the unwarranted continuing fear that the neighborhood's going to blow up is a different issue.
That's the dividing line. That's right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Poos. Mr. Smalley.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The appellee was asking below for the standard jury instruction that is given. Thank you. And has always been given. The appellee below is looking for the application of the law that has always existed in Ohio. Nuisance law protects a person's right to the peaceful enjoyment of their home. The use and peaceful enjoyment of their home was disrupted in this case, and it's disrupted by an explosion that does create fear, an explosion that leads to an evacuation where they can't get their pets and their medicine, they don't know what's going on, an explosion following which there are no answers because the company has no idea what went wrong to cause the explosion, an explosion that has left them unsure about whether their homes are safe after an explosion, and it was a huge explosion. It was not a small or a trifling matter. Now, most assuredly, it disrupted their peaceful enjoyment of their home. No question, it was an annoyance and an inconvenience, and it caused them fear.
Counsel, would you explain for me what you believe the Court of Appeals decision allowed in as evidence and as a standard for this additional recovery? What is your explanation of how that would play out and what type of recovery would be allowed under this current Court of Appeals decision?
Okay. Under this current Court of Appeals decision, Your Honor, I don't believe anything has changed. I believe this current Court of Appeals decision acknowledged and honored the traditional nuisance laws. The traditional nuisance laws, and I don't think anybody disputes it, has first and foremost proof that somebody using their land has actually committed an actionable nuisance or has maintained an actionable nuisance. Because just because one neighbor is annoyed or inconvenienced, as this Supreme Court said back in 1832, it doesn't mean that that is necessarily compensable. Every annoyance and inconvenience is not. It's a balancing test. And the Court of Appeals, I think, acknowledged traditional nuisance law in saying first and foremost, before a nuisance claim is actionable, before you have to prove there is a nuisance, and there's a balancing test between Isotech's right to use its property, even with ultra-hazardous chemicals and carelessness and neglect. They have a right to use their property, but that has to be balanced against the rights of the other homeowners. And that balancing test is where the substantiality, the materiality, the physical impact, the real, the occurrence has to be proven to even have a nuisance in the first instance. And that's where the gatekeeper gate should be kept. Because you shouldn't get to the damage section if...
I don't think we dispute all that. That's pretty plain, common black law. Where I'm having some trouble understanding him is, as I read the opinion, you can recover sort of a continuing nuisance because you're afraid now, even though nothing is happening. Is that how you read the Court of Appeals, that you can recover for continuing fear in the future?
It depends, Your Honor, on what the nuisance is. If the nuisance is simply an explosion, then there would not be a continuing allowance of recovery. Under what I believe the standard has always been, it is that the persons who have been subjected to a nuisance, a given, absolute, unquestioned nuisance, are entitled to recover annoyance, discomfort, and loss of enjoyable, peaceful use of their property. The nuisance in this case was not the explosion, not simply the explosion. The nuisance, as found by the court and reiterated over and over through the trial, was the processing of cryogenic distillation of nitric oxide, which is extremely hazardous, extremely dangerous, and needs to be controlled under very strict controls. And that nuisance was not abated until December of 2003. And the court found, as a matter of law, that that was indeed the nuisance. And that nuisance,
so
I believe,
if,
is...
So if you live next to an ammunition depot and you have a fear that all that volatile equipment might go up in smoke, or you live next to a fireworks store, will that in the future under this ruling be compensable because you live in fear of the condition of a neighbor, even though that hasn't extended into your property, but it's a fear?
No, clearly not, because that is an unrealized fear, and it isn't a nuisance in the first instance.
So you're saying if you have a nuisance in the first instance and you continue to be fearful of what's happening on the property next to you, even though nothing has invaded your property, that's recoverable? Is that what you believe they say?
I believe, Your Honor, if the evidence in the case proves that the nuisance has created a fear, has created a sense that you are not comfortable in your property, knowing this nuisance, something, a process that has been determined to be unreasonably dangerous to the neighbors. If that process is ongoing and it has been, that process has been determined to be a nuisance until
okay.
that is abated, yes, I
so,
believe if...
It, so basically, there under this theory, you can recover for something that you're fearful of, even though nothing... No fumes, no physical invasion, no odors, nothing has come onto your property, but it did once, and now you live in fear that it will again, and that is what you believe the Court of Appeals now allows recovery for. How is that not new law?
Because I believe, Your Honor, it has the notion of a continuing nuisance demands factual proof that there is indeed something.
Water on your property, something constructed over your land. Can you give me a case that we have in current law that allows fear when something's not physically coming into your property in odors or anything other way that allows fear? Can you give me a case in Ohio law that allows that, other than this one?
I don't know that I can talk about a case that evaluated a specific sense without a physical sensation as opposed to a very real emotional sensation. But to suggest that that is a distinction that should impact, if indeed we have a circumstance where a resident legitimately, factually, has a profound fear of ever living in their property again, and it is supported by that resident's attempt to find out that the reason there has been not one but four explosions and evacuations has been discovered and corrected. It's a legitimate, real, substantial, material concern that allows him not to be comfortable and enjoy the use of his property. It seems consistent with the notion of nuisance law.
Well, I thought your first response to Justice Stratton's question, I thought you said that just the processing in the plant of the processing that they in which they're engaged is the nuisance, which would suggest that even if there's no event as there was here, the neighbor could claim that a nuisance because I live next to this plant which is never had an incident. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, I misunderstood it. I thought that was your response to your first response to her question.
Well, I think when the explosion occurs, I think the explosion is significant. Clearly, I think the Court of Appeals was right in saying that the explosion is a nuisance.
Mr. Smalley, when you're talking about the proof of the emotional impact and so on, why doesn't the negligent infliction of emotional distress or the intentional infliction of emotional distress cover what you're suggesting here? Why does this need to be imported into nuisance law in the unusual fashion that the Court of Appeals has suggested?
We are not making a claim for infliction of emotional distress, which is not a claim that's ever been acknowledged under nuisance law. It is a claim for annoyance and discomfort and impact on the peaceful enjoyment of your property. And I think to the extent that fear demonstrates those things that have been classically recoverable in a property circumstance is what the Court of Appeals is talking about. I don't think we'd want to expand nuisance law to allow plaintiffs to recover an additional line item damage, for instance, for mental distress under the Fantozzi analysis.
You're saying that emotional distress falls within annoyance and discomfort? Is that what you're arguing?
Your Honor, I think the emotional reaction to the nuisance is evidence of annoyance. The emotional reaction to a nuisance, whether the emotional reaction is because it's ash falling on you or because it's noise or because it's an explosion that's rattled your house and now a process that is still uncontrolled and on the property, those are things that impact you emotionally that then damage your ability to peacefully enjoy your property.
And counsel, I want to follow up on Justice Lansinger's question, and because the question is, why didn't you come at this part of the injury or the claim for damages in a different way? Are there practical proof problems, or does our case law make it difficult for you to get at it in the way that she suggested?
It would honestly be more difficult, I believe, under the emotional distress, Paul v. Hanks, then you would show severe and debilitating injury, emotional harm, which I think it would be a tremendous divergence from.
So our case law there puts a burden on you that you can't get over. Is that?
I believe that's true. I believe it would leave uncompensated people that were legitimately and seriously impacted on their ability to peacefully enjoy the use of their property.
And follow up to the Chief and Justice Stratton's questions. But for the explosion, there's no case. Is that right? So
if it's a
munitions factory next to you and you know they're making a dirty bomb there, as long as there's no incident, the claim can't start.
You're exactly right. And I think the Court of Appeals acknowledged that in saying that an unrealized fear is not compensable. And the Court of Appeals also acknowledged that the standard OGI instruction contains the provisions in the annoyance and discomfort instruction that a trifling or insignificant.
I'm looking at paragraph 7 in the Court of Appeals opinion. The trial court did not err in refusing to admit evidence of fear and upset because the court actually allowed the plaintiffs to present considerable evidence on this point. Where the court did err was in instructing the jury that fear and upset could not be considered in deciding whether plaintiffs should recover damages for personal annoyance and discomfort. Is that the heart of
That's the heart of it. And keeping annoyance in the law, because it would go away with an insistence that there's physical injury. And annoyances would be gone. We'd write it out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smalley. Mr. Ankeny, you have a little more than 2 minutes.
Chief Justice, may it please the Court, let me start with that there was a claim in your petition for the class representative for emotional damage, but summary judgment was granted on that claim because it didn't rise to the level. Let me go to Justice O'Donnell's questions about the concerns and fears of the residents, because you have to understand what the trial judge did. The trial judge did allow evidence of fear for the residents where it was relevant to their compensable damages, either loss of use or annoyance and discomfort. So the people who, at the time of the explosion, had fear, and it created, you know, their heart to beat faster or, you know, had some emotional reaction at the time, that evidence was allowed in, and those people, I believe, recovered annoyance and discomfort at the time of the explosion.
Counsel, the way you're describing it, the judge and what you seem to think is okay is if it just scared the bejesus out of you when it happened, that's compensable.
Yes.
But if after it happens and you've been moved out of your home, you learn they're making a dirty bomb next door, and one of them went off, and now you're scared. I mean, the first thing, you didn't notice the TV was up so loud it didn't even scare you, but now when you learn after the fact this was a pretty dangerous thing next door, no compensation. Is that?
No, there's two answers to that. First of all, the judge did allow fear if it went to loss of use. And I think what you're talking about there is, and there was a housewife who refused to go into her one room or her screened-in porch or whatever out of fear for the explosion for a number of days after the explosion. He allowed that evidence in, and he allowed that to go to the jury for her loss of use of that room out of that fear. So the fear went to a compensable damage. The same thing was true of a jogger. A jogger refused to jog by the park or in the park he normally jogged in because of his fear of the plant as a result of him being there at the explosion. The trial judge properly allowed that in as evidence of compensable damages. Where we draw the line is where now all of a sudden you have these unrealized fears about, okay, this plant over here, it's just like the dirty bomb plant before the explosion. It's unrealized fears that don't lead to compensable damages. Antonick, if you read Antonick, there is a reason why you have to have material substantial physical discomfort. And we don't mean physical injury. I think if you read what the trial judge said in his rulings, I mean, this was briefed many times and argued a number of times. He reviewed Antonick and Bullock, and this case was only about damages, which makes it different from the cases in which you try a case with both liability and damage. If you had this case with a combined case of liability and damages, the Antonick standard, I think they would admit the Antonick standard would be allowed to be instructed to the jury. And then the judge would give the OJI. And we'd be happy with that. That would allow the jury to know that the damages that they are assessing go to the injuries that are alleged in the nuisance. And those injuries have to be material, substantial. They can't be trivial. And if you take any words out of there, if you take physical discomfort out, why don't you take immaterial out? Why don't you take take substantial out? Antonick says you have to have all of those. And there's a reason, because these are the types of things that could be very trivial unless you tell the jury.
What do you precisely understand the – I mean, you have an instruction from the trial judge. Court of Appeals said it was too limiting. What do you understand the Court of Appeals to be saying the instruction should have been?
I think, reading the Court of Appeals opinion, they say you can leave all the Antonick language in except take out the word physical. That's how I would read it, and that's how I would argue it to Judge Langer, because that, if you read their opinion, all they say, he erred in adding a physical element. Now, if this court decides that's appropriate, you know, we could live with that, but I think that's violating what Antonick says, that there needs, and the progeny, Schoenberger and the other cases, is there has to be some physical sense involved. You know, if the explosion, there's a light, or there's a smell, or there's something. Your heart, and the judge allowed heartbeat to go up. There was a physical sense of the heartbeat
going
up.
So you indicate, I mean, you're citing to us a bunch of Court of Appeals decisions, and we're going to write something that's now going to bind everybody. And you're suggesting that the Court of Appeals maybe was just saying take the word physical out of the charge and it's okay.
I think clearly that's what the Court of Appeals said. They only say the error was in adding the physical discomfort in there. And I think you're right. I think this court needs, having been through the pretrial briefs and with the judge and the parties, there is some confusion. And a lot of the confusion is everybody mixes loss of use damages with annoyance and discomfort damages. That was the problem with Bullock, where they talk about fear in the Bullock case. Well, that fear was evidence of loss of use because she couldn't let her grandchildren play in the backyard. There was a loss of use in the backyard. So there's a lot of confusion in the cases because they gave $10,000 damages, but that's loss of use, there's annoyance and discomfort, there's repairs, and they're not broken out. So I think this court needs to make it clear there's three elements or three types of damages. You get repairs, you get loss of use, and you get annoyance and discomfort. Annoyance, discomfort is a class of those damages. It's not you get it for annoyance, you get it for discomfort, you get it for inconvenience. It's annoyance and discomfort. And what is annoyance and discomfort is the key issue of this case. Does it include that word physical?
Where does severe mental anguish fit in this?
It would only be a separate cause. I mean, it would have
separate
to be
cause.
Emotional distress, which was pled in summary judgment on. If there's emotional distress, they can claim emotional distress as a result of the negligent act or the ultra-hazardous act. They can claim that as a separate count or a separate action for that damage. That would be separately. But you are entitled to prove fear. I think the trial judge logically allowed fear to show when it was relevant to compensable damages, loss of use or annoyance and discomfort. And I think that if you look at it, the Antonick standard and the reasoning behind it in the progeny is right. I just think you need to make it clear.
You're saying that mental distress is not a part of nuisance, the damages deriving from nuisance. Is that right?
Well, I think they have to be pled as separate as emotional distress, yes.
So you're saying there can be an emotional component like fear if you're talking about the loss of use, if you're talking about the annoyance and discomfort. But if you're talking about fear alone, then and severe fear alone, you would be talking about an entirely separate cause of action that in this case was summaried out.
Sure, absolutely. If you had a homeowner who couldn't live in their house, and that could happen. I could see how that happened. There could be a homeowner who lived close to the plant and this scared them so much, reasonably, that they could say, I can't live in that house again. Well, that is a cause of action, and that would over that. I'm sure the evidence in that case, if it rose to the level, would be able to go to the jury for that loss. But that's not annoyance and discomfort. That's not loss of use.
Counsel, I'm interested in the interplay here between the OJI instruction and the rules of evidence, and wonder why it would be such a problem to simply give the instruction discomfort and annoyance as an element of damages, but yet during the trial court controls what evidence is admitted to exclude those kinds that deal with unrealized fear. Instruction apparently has been around for some time. Why would there be a problem with that? And it seems like, in a sense, that happened in this case, except maybe the trial judge then expanded the standard definition as well. And having not done that, perhaps would not have been an issue.
I don't believe the judge expanded the definition. The issue, and I think the confusion here,
well, he went to attempt to further define annoyance, discomfort and annoyance, which is not part of the standard instruction.
Well, it's not part of the standard instruction, but the problem is this was a severed trial for only damages, and the amount of damages you give for annoyance, discomfort is the OJI. Unfortunately, since it was a severed trial, there was not the standard for what the injuries need to be that you would give if this was a liability trial, because the standard there is the Antonick standard, and you could give, I think it's very proper in the liability phase, and I think the plaintiffs and the Court of Appeals agree, in a liability phase, you could give that Antonick instruction to the jury to describe what the standard there is for the jury to know what injuries are compensable. If you don't give that instruction, which why the judge gave it in this case is, then the jury can think, well, we could give this for any trivial annoyance, which is clearly not the law.
So the problem or the issue arises out of the fact that there was an admission of liability, so the jury didn't hear the original limiting rule in terms of when you find nuisance.
Absolutely. I think if this had been a joint trial, we would have given the Antonick instruction, we would have given OJI, and I think everybody would have been happy.
You know, again, this gets back to my first question about what was admitted, and you just said to Justice Cupp that liability was admitted.
Only liability. Only liability.
But then in the brief talks about that Aldrich contests proximate cause and damages. So to me, I mean, you're talking about a breach of duty, which is the first element, and was proximate cause part of this phase or was it not?
Proximate cause definitely was. I think there's some confusion about when you say admit liability. We didn't use the words we admit liability. We avoided the trial that was their defining nuisance. We said we accept the responsibility for our acts and that we would go forward with the trial just on proximate cause and damages. The judge then made a finding. I think there's a lot of argument about what it was, but I think you can find in the record that there is, it lays out by the judge what the findings were, and the findings were we would go to trial in this phase on proximate cause and damages.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.